The story of Ethernet is best told in personal stories shared by its very own creators, providers, and users. The Voices of Ethernet Archive is dedicated to preserving Ethernet's oral history, recording pivotal events that may have been forgotten or remain unknown, through a collection of spoken records with the individuals engaged in the technology's global emergence as the foundation of Internet.
Today, we're going to talk to Robert Garner. Thanks for joining us, Robert. Could you please introduce yourself?
All righty. I'm Robert Garner. I've been working here in Silicon Valley since 1976. Bob Metcalf was the first guy to hire me. I worked on the Ethernet there, and then after working at Xerox PARC for a while with Lynn Conway, I left there, went to Sun Microsystems, and at Sun Microsystems, I was the co-architect of the Spark architecture and designed the first Spark machines. And Sun was an amazing place to be, and I stayed there until about 1998. Worked at Brocade for a little while, and then went to IBM Research, and here I am.
That's sort of a fascinating journey, and you've mentioned a bunch of places with a very high profile. And when I came out of college, because when I was in college, it was, you know, I think the top end we worked on was at AX 11750. But a few years later, around about 95, I actually got to work on Spark workstations. So I actually made a living using the things that you built. And I did like them very much.
We were very proud of Spark because we defined it in the context of a system, the software people, you know, compiler people, OS people, and some crazy people, Bill Joy and Andy Bechtolsheim. And you know, we just were really proud of what we built and what we accomplished. Dave Patterson was an amazing father figure.
So that's like the, that's a lot of the royalty.
Yeah, I enjoyed it. I'd live it all again.
So what was the driver for you to get involved with Ethernet? What got you there, and like, when was that, and like, how did that all work out?
Well, it was very simple. I was at Stanford getting my master's degree, and I went to a campus interview, and this guy named Bob Metcalf interviewed me. Pretty remarkable man for an interview. And he was in the process. This is 1976. He was bringing on board his team to productize the what had been accomplished, the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center, his invention of the Ethernet in 1973, and the creation of the Alto personal computer in 1973 and 74. So he had been given the task of hiring a team to commercialize that. And
you mean to bring his idea to life?
To bring his idea to the marketplace. And you know, his idea was developed inside Xerox. At that time, Xerox had a patent on it. They had built probably and distributed by that time, you know, maybe 1,000 Altos around universities at Stanford, even in the House of Representatives. People could see that the networking worked and the Alto worked. So the move and the push was on to get a product out the door from Xerox. And Bob,
there's an interesting thing from, I had this idea, I showed it working with one or two of them, and now I succeeded, people actually want to buy them.
Well, we thought that the world, you know, it was like we were on drugs. You know, we had this thing that is a personal computer as we know it today with a bitmap screen. I mean, I have one sitting next to me here, the Alto, a network.
So could I just borrow it just for a little while? I promise I'll take care of it.
This is an original Alto 1, which is still being...
Does it still work?
This one in particular is still being restored. You can go online and see about the restoration of other Altos. But you know, we were just fascinated. It was just so compelling, so much better than, you know, printers and 300 baud modem lines. What you see is what you get. Screen, laser printers. We had to bring this to market, and Bob was part of that. He hired a top-notch team of people, about half a dozen people. It included somebody I had as an instructor at Stanford, Roy Ogus. Ron Crane, who was an analog expert, and myself, we were tasked to do the Ethernet. Now,
What was at work? Because I imagine that team would have been pretty diverse in the way they did things. Like, what was it like in that environment?
Well, we were actually co-resident with PARC. This was actually in the system development division. We had offices we could share with the PARC people. I think that's what made the transfer from research to development really work by being rubbing shoulders. And we had lunch in the park cafeteria with the storied heroes there, Butler Lampson and Chuck Thacker. So we felt part of the culture. Xerox PARC had a lot of, they didn't call themselves prima donnas, but everyone was brilliant. And you could just pick up the vibes. And there was also, there were two cultures there. There was
so there's a lot of very strong personalities and people who believed in their own way of seeing things.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. And Bob was part of that. He was a great leader. He could push his ideas. And he was also funny. I mean, there was this combination of kind of a steely persona and then a Groucho Marx, a sense of humor. And there
just
was
picking into that just for a second, right?
What's that?
I'm trying to think about it. It's like I can't think what it would be like to have Bob Metcalfe as a boss. So how was that? How did that work out?
He was the best boss I've ever had. I mean, imagine someone who could convince you to do anything and didn't take fools lightly. So if he thought someone was on the wrong course, he let everybody know through his humor. He was very determined in direction. He also wore his heart on his shoulder. He some people are introspective and they're more private. Bob is more extrospective. And he can really read other people. He can see where they're coming from. He can get them to think of his idea and make it think it was their own. So he was very skilled.
So some people you see are sort of unidirectional, right? They transmit only. What you're saying is he did both well.
Yeah, he did both directions. And he had a spark in him that he cared about you.
Oh, nice joke on the spark, by the way.
Yeah, sorry about that.
That's a bit early, right? I thought you designed it later on.
Yeah, he just a remarkable man to work for.
So, you mentioned a few people, right? Can you just give me, like, talk about a couple of these people and like what they're, what things stand out to you about working with them? I mean, I know there was a lot of them, but like, just give me just a couple of them.
Well, Butler Lampson had his finger in everything at PARC and in the System Development Division in a way. He was beyond brilliant. He would kind of like, I hate to say it, but kind of like Christ and his disciples. everyone looked up to Butler because his word was usually right. And he also spoke faster than most people could think. So Butler was a real leader and charm person there. Chuck Thacker, who I worked with very closely, was also brilliant. Chuck could design, 10 hardware circuits, probably the time it would take a normal mortal to design two. And he wrote software. And he really, his background was as a physics major. So if he were tired designing circuits and stuff, he would ask you physics puzzles.
I actually am a physics minor. I went to college planning to be a physics major before I figured out it wasn't going to pay. But I'm one of those strange people who likes quantum mechanics.
Indeed, yes. Well, I have Feynman's books up here. So there's so many personalities.
So he was an awesome lecturer. Some of the stories about him are just wonderful.
So Bob Taylor, was what really made the place click. He had hired all the great people and he really also really cared about people and he had a very strong vision about what should be done, that computers should communicate. Bob, again, he had very high standards and if you didn't meet them, he would let you know.
So how far up the stack did Bob really work? Because I think what you told me is the person you just told me about had the overall vision of communicating. And there's
Bob Taylor work or Bob Metcalfe?
Bob Metcalfe, right? Because there's this huge vision of all the things that have to come together. And well, Bob, it's difficult for anyone to understand all of it.
Yeah. Bob cut his teeth designing IMP interfaces for the ARPANET. I mean, when he came to Xerox PARC in 1972, without his PhD at that point, his first job was to build an IMP, that was the message processor for the ARPANET, to connect the Max computer that they had designed at PARC to the ARPANET. So he had a lot of, and his whole PhD thesis was in packet communication. So he had bought into the whole communication scenario, and you know, he had visited Hawaii and the Lolonet people. And he, when he came, you know, when Butler said it's we need to network, but Taylor said we need to network these computers, Bob said, well, I've got the network. I've got the simple approach. They said it has to fit on one board.
So his thing was, well, these people I'm like working with have a problem to solve, and I have the key, I know how to build the key part that lets them do their job.
Yeah, yeah. So Bob, you know, along with David Boggs, Bob was not really an analog engineer. He was more of a system engineer and a software guy, architect. So he met Dave Boggs there at Park, and together they prototyped the first card, wrote the first microcode for the card, and got it up and running. Ran at 3 megabits per second, and it worked from day one. I mean,
Bob did explain to me why that number made sense. It was because it saved them, I think, another clock circuit on the board.
Well, that's become a bit of a legend. You know, I have the card, and believe me, there's room in the card for a clock circuit. But it really has more to do with there wasn't a lot of bandwidth in the Alto. The remarkable thing about the Alto is the screen took up 2/3 of the memory bandwidth, only about 3 megabytes per second, and half the memory. So there really wasn't a lot of bandwidth. So, and in the microcode task scheme, 3 megabits per second and the 20 microsecond latency could just be handled. So it was just barely doable what the Alto was capable of doing.
So your argument is that's a good reason, but the actual fact is it was enough.
It was so fast. I mean, Bob will tell you that technically it ran at 2.94 megabits per second and the difference was the ARPANET, but of course, no one really filled it up to 3 megabits per second because the typical transfer rate between two Altos was on the order of, you know, maybe 100 kilobits per second, maybe a peak of 300 kilobits per second. So if you had 10 people all using the network at once, maybe you would fill it up, but that didn't happen. So it was just a perfect match for the environment.
What were the key things that you were there for, right? What were the things that you look back and say, well, that was cool, I got to do?
For my work at Xerox, it was, I had the chance to basically, you know, come up with the commercial implementation of the Ethernet, the very first commercial implementation. So the way it was working is, it wasn't like, let's go design an Ethernet interface for a VAX or a DEC machine or a Nova machine. Boggs did design Ethernet network for the Nova, sold a new machine, Tracy Kidder machine, because they had a lot of Novas there at Park initially. But the objective was not
build. How did the Nova fit with the Alto? Was it the newer and better one? The Alto was the sort of experimental, and the Nova was the production.
They had an Ethernet. Dave and Bob designed an Ethernet interface for both the Alto and the Nova, and the Nova Ethernet card was used as a gateway. So they would use the Nova to connect multiple Ethernets together.
Okay.
So when we went to commercialize it, it wasn't just design a controller for a certain system. It was, we need to design a whole better Alto. You know, this was a nice system, but it wasn't perfect. It was designed in only 4 months. It's got a lot of hiccups and issues, and it would be fast.
4 months.
So Chuck Thacker
designed the first personal computer in 4 months.
Chuck Thacker and Butler Lampson, Ed McCrae did that. That's what they say. Yes, and then they had to make some prototypes, and they used another part of Xerox to build out this pre-production. But so this mentality, this ability, you know, how can we transfer this to and make it, you know, product ready? So, well, let's build a whole new workstation. So the plan was to build a better Alto, and Chuck Thacker, it was called the D0 for the first display word processor. So Chuck would design the whole processor in conjunction with engineers in El Segundo. And Roy August, myself, and Ron Crane would design the Ethernet card. I don't have it because it turns out that system is sometimes referred to as a second system syndrome. You try so hard to make it better that it's so complex, it's got bugs and issues. And he'll say it wasn't a commercial success. He's being very, but it was targeted for both an engine and a laser printer and as a workstation. So the workstation guys said, it's too expensive.
You had that problem. You had the trying to solve too many different masters.
Yes, we had that problem. And I learned, a kid right out of school, you know, seeing the processor run into these problems. And, you know, Chuck later admitted he didn't follow Maxwell. You know, he didn't do good DC static timing analysis. It was very complex. But we actually had the 10 megabit Ethernet controller working in the lab in 1978. So 10 megabits per second running in the lab between two D0s in 1978. And it worked fine, but that system didn't make it to market. And what happened at that point is Bob, who has an entrepreneur aspect to himself, actually left Xerox in late 78 because he said, look, this was supposed to take 2 years. You know, the Alpha guys did it in 4 months. You know, why did it take more than 2 years? And he wasn't willing to wait around for the next 2 years, which Bob Belleville became my boss. And we designed Xerox Star, which did ship in 1981 with an Ethernet. That became the first commercial 10 megabit Ethernet. But Bob was not patient enough to wait. He needed to go change the world. So he knew that Gordon Bell at DEC knew all about the Alto and the Ethernet. So he went to go consult with Project Mac at MIT and with Gordon Bell. And that made Ethernet successful because Gordon Bell then contacted Xerox executives and said, could you please open it? Let's work on it together. You know, Xerox, you don't want to get in the business of making Ethernet controller cards and transceivers. That's stupid.
I want what you have.
But Gordon Bell was so instrumental in the success of Ethernet by doing that. So here we were, you know, we had designed a working card, but then the system didn't ship. By the way, it did actually ship in small numbers. Xerox announced the 5700 electronic copier, laser printer, I'm sorry. And you know, $200,000, no one bought them. it just wasn't ready yet for the Xerox Star. We had a low cost laser printer that you could attach to it. So,
I mean, most people are stunned to know that laser printers go back that far because we tend to think of them as coming after dot matrix and ink printers. And you go, you know, the technology has been around for a while. I guess Xerox made it start being a copy machine.
Oh, Gary Starkweather and Ron Ryder, they built this machine called EARS, which had, you know, a character generator and a full one page per second, high resolution laser printer. We were all using that at Xerox PARC in 76. I would print documents with foreign fonts on it. People would go, how the hell did you make that? You know, it's
so I have a note here about an electric story that you threatened to tell us.
So I joined in July 76. Ron Crane, the analog expert, joined a little bit a month before me. We became close friends. I came into work on January 5th, 1978, a little late because we stayed up till 2 or 3 a.m. Right? You know, we're going to change the world. We didn't realize we weren't a startup company with options. You know, we would work literally until 2 or 3 in the morning.
To some extent, the people who are most fun to work with don't work for the money, right? They work for the belief and the passion.
Oh, we were so passionate. I would ride my bike to park and back to the hotel. I mean, the motel I was staying in, and I'd have to drive by a cemetery at 2 a.m. in the morning. That was pretty spooky. But yeah, we stayed up all night. So I came in late that morning and there was a ladder up in the ceiling and Ron Crane up on the ladder, pulling transceivers, down from the ceiling. And I, you know, what happened? Well, if you live here in the Bay Area, you know that electrical storms are not very common. Lightning had struck, the hill or near one of our buildings and the Ethernet was between two buildings.
You had that problem. So lightning strike between the buildings.
Yeah, there was a voltage difference and it wasn't, that shouldn't have happened, but one of the technicians found a wrench still connected to the transceiver touching the cable tray. And so, you know, there was a clear connection between the transceiver and earth ground here and another one up there. And so some large voltage on the cable blew out about a dozen transceivers. And that day, of course, IBM executives were to come to see how great the Ethernet
was. Of course, right. It's always the day of the demo that things start to explode.
Yeah, exactly. There was a similar story where on the Alto, they were gonna have executives come watch and they installed the 33rd Ether network, you know, behind gateways. And the field was always...
Did anyone actually ever install the 13th? Or did you just skip that one over?
Oh, no, they installed it. I mean, there is actually, you know...
13 being the unlucky number.
Yeah, the Alto didn't have enough memory. The Star didn't have enough memory. They only had a table, a 5-bit table for the number of networks. You know, Park definitely did the first internet, you know, the ability, the Park Universal Packet PUP format to send stuff over regardless of what the network is. But there was actually, there's a story about how the MAC address got so large. So the Alto here has
I was just about to ask that, right?
Okay.
How it became that particular size?
Limitation story. So the Alto here had an 8-bit serial number and then an 8-bit network number.
So you weren't planning to build more than 256 of them?
Yeah, networks. No. There was only one at Park for many years until there became three. And then eventually, like I said, there were more than 32. But one day, apparently, someone moved an Alto from one building, i.e. network, to another. And in that other network, two Altos had the same serial number.
How long did it take to work that out?
They're pretty smart, probably in less than a day. In fact, I think it had the serial number for Max, the main file server at the time. So they realized, wait a minute.
So they plugged it in and all of a sudden the file server went out to lunch.
Yeah, so all of a sudden people realized that, we need to, you know, we have a management problem of numbers and we need to make the field bigger. So when... Yeah.
And unfortunately, of course, you wouldn't have had any of these nice monitoring tools that we get used to.
No, you can see everything on the network. So in that sense, it was not too hard. There was no encryption, one of the faults of the Ethernet. And Ed Taft, by the way, who was the mastermind behind PUP and IFS and these tools, he sent a mail message noting...
Just for those who don't follow quite so much, that is the precursor protocols to all the internet protocols that succeeded, correct?
Yeah. And Ed Taft and Dave Boggs and Bob did a first version, but... he sent this apologetic message out saying, you know, we have kind of have protections, but you realize that anyone can read anything that goes by on your Alto, so look out. And, you know, and we're people from the outside, ARPANET can get inside, so it was a scramble.
I assume you didn't explain that in great detail to the military type people who would have been a bit concerned.
No. So, but anyways, back to the story then. So when we were going to productize the Ethernet, it actually changed names. This was Xerox's thing and it was called the Xerox Wire. There was the idea that you would have an information outlet in the wall and Xerox was going to own it, they thought at that point. And the target speed was, the official speed was going to be 10 megabits per second. Bob Metcalf wanted to push things like he always pushed everything. And so internal speed was 20. But as part of that design, the design had a 32-bit MAC address. And when people started working with DEC in particular, they and Will Crowther at Xerox PARC said, I think we need to go to, you know, bigger numbers. So people were making calculations. If every computer weighed a kilogram, it would be the mass of the earth. So, you know, so it ended up at 48 bits.
I mean, it sounds like one of those in the middle things we've seen a few times. It's like, well, I've got 32, I'd like 64. But 48's right in the middle, so why don't we compromise?
Yeah, well, right now I've been interviewing people for the paper I'm working on, and people are saying, I wish it was 64.
If you think about this as the start of your career, right, what's a couple of the key things you took with you as you moved on?
I think one of the key things I learned at Xerox was that it's really important to listen to everybody. Sometimes, you know, you might get disillusioned or there might be problems. Frequently a solution or an insight to a problem exists in your organization with people who are there. And if you just take the time to listen to everybody, you're amazed to find out that there's a potential solution out there. It's just that you couldn't see it. You have to sit down and listen.
That, of course, has been a problem in Silicon Valley with so many people who think they have the answer.
Yeah.
Right? Exactly. So we have the strong opinions and the great talent, but it's hard to have that. Plus what you said with Metcalf, where he had the ability to be visionary and brilliant, but also listen. Right, that's a rare combination.
Yeah, you really have to sit and listen. And I guess one of the things that I learned probably between Xerox and Sun was never assume that you'll get everything finished over the weekend. And in fact, it's more likely that when you come back with your colleagues on Monday that the requirements will have changed. So all the work you did over the weekend is not important anymore. we tended to be into this mindset that, I'll go to all the meetings on Monday through Friday, but I'll have time this weekend to get the job done. But that doesn't work.
This is a big leading question, but, how did Ethernet impact the world? I mean, it's a huge question, but it's one of those top level, right? If you look back, what do you think is sort of the consequences of the work that got done then?
Well, it's incalculable. I mean, I like to say that every computer to human, human to computer, human to human communication today goes over an Ethernet at some point.
I mean, clearly, the way we're talking is over a lot of Ethernet links.
Yeah. So, I mean, Bob, people back then tended to want to do something complex so they could impress their friend. But, Bob understood people, that people would make things too complex and there'd be weird problems in corner cases. So just keep it simple. He had a very famous phrase, which was, reliability means not having to say you're sorry. Keeping the hardware as simple as possible, what could be more simple than just speak up? If you want to send a packet, just start talking and deal with the issues.
That's a bit like the lesson for documents and products and standards, which is you're not done until there's nothing left to take out.
Yeah, exactly. So just speak up. And if two people, speak at the same time, well, just back off, back off. And back off randomly if you can, So very simple idea. So it worked on a cable. It obviously worked in switches, and the very first switches that were built weren't full throughput, And so if the microcode ran out of resources, it knew it could just drop a packet and the whole thing would still work because a reliable transport protocol above would go fix it up.
Yes, so, I wrote a bunch of code on those devices, be it microcode for NPUs or be it just forwarding code in like a 68302. Yeah. The protocol set was forgiving of the reality of the time.
Yeah. So it gave hardware people a break. You didn't have to be perfect. Switches are very hard to design. The technology wasn't quite ready initially. You have to break packets up into pieces, put them in memory, reassemble them, and blah, blah, blah. But that eventually got there. So Ethernet, Bill Joy, who I worked with, dear friend at Sun Microsystem, had a phrase that I always remembered, which was, technology speaks for itself. Technology speaks for itself. Sometimes we think that, it's all business. I mean, certainly business plays a big role. Bob will tell you about the importance of business and Ethernet and the ecosystem. But sometimes if the basic technology is good, it just lives on its own, speaks for itself.
That's the thing I take away, which is you're not building it so you can see it. You're building it so it can get used.
Right. Yeah, you're building it. Well, people talk and computers need to talk. It's that simple.
I think maybe the other point you got into there was it was built deliberately open-ended. So it wasn't, it's going to do this thing alone. It's like, we're going to enable these set of things and people can go and do what they want with it.
Yeah. Yep. And people, because of its simplicity, people could try to take it different directions. And if they got burned, they got burned. They gave them a little bit. So I've got a few pieces of hardware to show you if you want.
Please.
Okay, so let's talk about the Alto first. I mean, just really briefly, here's the storied Alto. So a half a megabit display, a bitmap display, really audacious position they took because it actually took up half of main memory, 128 kilobytes, an eighth of a megabyte of main memory. Took up half of it, two thirds of the memory bandwidth. Everyone thought they were just off the chart. Why go through much work to make something look pretty? Keyboard and mouse as we know it, the Ethernet, transceivers that connected to it, 3 megabit there, the 2.5 megabyte removable disk pack, which was kind of neat if you're Alto ever.
How much? How big? 2.5 megabytes?
2.5 megabytes, yeah.
Wow.
Well, a lot bigger than the 120 kilobytes of main memory. I'll never forget Don Knuth coming and going with his disk pack at Xerox PARC. All the pieces we know of a PC as we knew it in the 1980s and 90s. And the remarkable thing about it was that it was a a micro, the CPU was divided up into micro tasks. And so the display, the disk, and the Ethernet microcode actually did all the transfers from little tiny buffers to main memory. So this was actually the first commercial Ethernet card that Dave Boggs and Bob Metcalf designed. Not commercial, the first one used at Park.
It's ginormous.
Yeah, so it looks big, but hey, this only contains a 32-byte buffer, and it's half duplex. So the Ethernet's half duplex, either sends or receives, so this is only half duplex. So in addition to that, let's just say you need a whole bunch more cards, because that's not all. So you need an ALU, right? So here's the ALU. It's divided up among the various I/O devices. It's a microcoded machine. Remember what microcode is. You need a control store, double width card. So you see, now we're starting to get there. This took more work than what meets the eye. You need a memory controller, borrowed from the Max computer they had designed. And you need 17 of these that used Intel 1103s, 1 kilobit DRAMs, 1 kilobit, the first DRAMs ever commercially produced. They were a little leery of using core, probably a good idea. So you needed 17.
Yeah, probably a good idea.
So, you know, you basically have got a half rack here of 25 or so cards left to right. And so that's what it took to get you your personal workstation. So it also cost, in today's dollars, probably about $40,000 to $50,000. So about half to a third of the price in Sunnyvale. So imagine when you join Xerox, like I did, they give you half of a home in your office.
So and tell you to be kind to it, and please don't break it.
If one broke, you just took the disk out and plugged it into the other one. So over here we have the second system commercialization, which is the Xerox Star. It had
another famous name.
Yeah, it had a 7.8 megahertz clock, a bit faster, 137 nanosecond cycle time. This guy was 170. Nanoseconds, but the same things, keyboard display, the cards, you get a little more compression. So the same idea, Butler Lampson came up with an idea of managing the tasks differently. And the Alto, if you had microcode, if you ran too long, you could screw everybody else up. And Butler Lampson said, why don't we just give everyone a fixed time slot with the microcode? So the Ethernet code will always know it's going to get a time slot and a certain latency, and that was a brilliant idea. So this is the Ethernet and the laser printer card for the Xerox Star. So the top half was the Ethernet part that I and Ron Crane designed, and the bottom half drives the laser printer, which could be a low-end laser printer. But again, that's not the whole thing. You need CPU card. So here's the CPU card. Based on AMD 2901, 16-bit, just like the Alto was 16-bit. Here's the control store now. So if just wave your hand over this, convert the control store into SRAM, and convert this into a 32-bit microprocessor, and you have RISC.
And today that would be about like yay big.
It's some quarter of my phone in my pocket. Yeah. So that's the hardware choice.
So can you tell us a little bit about the project you're working on? Because I've heard a little bit about it, and I think it's really interesting.
We're coming up to the 50th anniversary of the creation of the Ethernet, timed off of Bob Metcalf's memo, where he kind of coined the term Ether Network. By the way, there was a nice, just give you an example of his humor. The very first two Altos that the Ethernet was installed in outside of the prototype were called Michelson and Morley. Because they had granted use of the term to Bob, because they didn't need, they had proved it doesn't exist. So then Bob could use the term Ethernet. So that was
pretty that's a pretty inside joke.
Definitely. It's the 50th anniversary, and one of the IEEE person was looking to understand a little bit more of the history, and said, not much has been written about the work on the 10 megabit part before DEC, Intel, AMD, MOSTEC, Interlan, Exalan, all these other companies got involved. So kind of what happened there? So I've decided to go back, and you look online, not a lot has written about it. So I said, let's write that up. And
there is the book about 3Com that I've read.
Yes, there's a 3Com book. There's the Triumph of Ethernet book, which is by Berg, which is a great book on the business success of Ethernet. But there's not a lot of technical history. And so I realized I can't really just start with 10. So I'm going to look at the 10 year from 1973 to 1983 from a technical perspective.
When do you think you'll finish?
Well, the project got bigger. So now I don't think it'll be done till early next year.
Okay. So is there any sort of last thoughts you'd like to leave us with? Because, I mean, clearly we could, I could happily talk to you for another like 4 or 5 days, but that's sort of the Computer History Museum oral history. Any final thoughts about the whole evolution of Ethernet and how it's affected you and the rest of the world?
As a combination between the fundamental simplicity of it, Bob Metcalf's tutelage over it over all these years, and people's desire to make communications that work and that are easy, has enabled, I mean, just beyond anyone's imagination, the entire world to be interconnected for better or worse.
That I think is where satisfaction comes in, to go back and go, oh, that was really good. Yeah. And it's not to do with how much money you made. It's like, oh, I got to contribute to that.
Yeah, no, you can't. You can't take your dollar bills to your grave with you, right? But you can take your good memories and the feelings of success.
Robert, thank you very much. This has been a fascinating conversation. And as I said, I'd happily do this for another 5 days, but I'm not sure our viewers would watch. I do look forward to when your project finishes, because we would like to cover it. So thank you very much for your time, and hopefully we'll get together in person sometime soon.
Okay, thank you very much, Peter.
Tune in to hear other voices of Ethernet as we continue to document the evolution of Ethernet since 1973 and explore where the technology's story might go next. Thanks for joining.